Years ago, I tried to set up a film based on the diaries of Harriet Wilson. History students will remember that of all the courtesans plying their trade at the beginning of the 18th century, she was the most notorious. Among her clients was the old Duke of Wellington, and it was he who coined the phrase "publish and be damned" when she tried to get money out of him in return for not selling her raunchy story. A juicy part for Trevor Howard, or, alternatively, Brando, if I'd got American backing. The movie would have had the surefire ingredients of nudity, sex and violence added to a serious study of a corrupt society, a combination irresistible to intellectuals and critics alike, as well as providing the soft porn Joe Public can pay to see with a clear conscience. To get this project off the ground, I decided I needed an address in the West End. Even in those days, the normal rents were beyond my reach. One lunchtime, I was having a drink at Noel's. No, not the Master's Ebury Street home, but a little club in Soho that was trying to cash in on his name. It had been the old Nuts and Bolts nightclub in the '20s, later the Manhattan, and after that the Calypso Paradiso. But at the time I'm talking about, it was being run by the Greek cousin of a woman who had auditioned for me unsuccessfully when I was casting a tour of the Bing Boys of 1957. I mentioned my accommodation problem, and he offered me an office on the premises. He said he'd recently had it converted and I could move in immediately. Well, the accommodation turned out to be not a room at all, but a disused staircase, ground floor to basement. Manoli's conversion turned out to be the addition of a 40-watt bulb and a sign on the door saying private. The horizontal floor space was about a yard square, not even room for a desk. I managed to fit a piece of chipboard the size of a breakfast tray to the wall opposite, but it had to be hinged to allow the door to open. Once I was inside, there was just room for me to sit on an upright chair and lower the chipboard into position. Fortunately, there was a phone, for incoming calls only, in the nearby cloakroom, and the girl in charge there, Jennifer, of whom much more later, was kind and helpful about taking messages. Nevertheless, as a power base, it was pathetic. There was no way more than one person could get into it, for one thing. But I hung a curtain across the stairs halfway down and kept my files, etc., on the steps at my feet, and whenever I heard a knock on the door, on which I'd put a sign, "Londinium Productions, J. Kingston Platt," I opened it about 6 inches and sort of slithered out and said, "I'm so sorry, my office is full of clutter at the moment. We're about to move to our other place in Park Lane, so shall we adjourn to the bar? So much more civilized, don't you think?" But this is all background to my story about Jennifer. I mentioned that she was the hat check girl. It would also be true to say that she was the star of Noel's. I'm sure she attracted more trade than any of the girls employed as hostesses. Most of these girls were willing to provide after-hours entertainment for a negotiable fee, but Jennifer never had anything to do with this flesh-peddling, though it was obviously not for want of offers. She was easily the most attractive girl in the place. I used to wonder why she worked in that crummy place at all, and I was told it was because the hours fitted in with her widowed father's. He was in poor health and had a part-time maintenance job at a block of flats. I also heard that when they'd saved enough money, she and her boyfriend would get married and buy a place large enough to accommodate all three of them. In the squalid surroundings of Soho, Jennifer and Richard stood out as a very wholesome couple. It was also a pleasure to pass the time of day with her when I picked up mail or collected messages. I never actually met Richard until the day I'm going to tell you about it. It was a day on which I'd had a liquid lunch with a potential backer for Harriet's diary, who not only scoffed at my plans, but actually tried to get backing out of me for a project of his own. So after I'd paid for 4 gin and tonics apiece, I cancelled the lunch I'd arranged, bought a pastrami sandwich at the local deli, and took it back to eat in my office. I'd just scoffed the last crumb and emitted the sort of loud burp which is a minor pleasure of eating alone when I thought I heard someone sobbing behind my curtain on the steps at the bottom of my staircase. I asked the obvious question, "Who's that?" There was the sound of a sniff and a nose being blown. "It's only me, Mr. Platt." "Who is me?" "Jennifer, Mr. Platt." "Jennifer, goodness gracious me, whatever's the matter?" I went down the steps and pulled the curtain aside. There she was, sitting at the bottom, tearful and frightened. She reminded me of Lillian Gish in one of the old silent greats. "I'm hiding. Please don't tell anyone I'm here. I'll keep perfectly quiet. I won't bother you at all, but I have to stay here until he goes away."
"Who goes away?"
"Richard. Have you had a tiff?" "He's outside. He followed me here, apparently. He's spying on me."
"Why should he be spying?"
"Oh, Mr. Platt, I can't explain."
"Please don't call me Mr. Platt."
"All right, I can't explain. Kingston. Just call me John."
"John, then. That's better. Are you being threatened, or what?"
"I'm not sure. He might get violent if he found out. He's terribly jealous."
"Found out what?"
"That's what I can't tell you. The trouble is, he wouldn't understand."
"But doesn't he call for you every day?"
"Not in the afternoon. When I've finished my 2-hour stint over lunch, I go home by tube, except Fridays."
This was a Friday.
"He only picks me up at night. The last 9 Fridays I haven't been telling him where I go or what I do."
"Why not?"
"Well, he's a bit of a prude, you see, Mr. John. And I couldn't risk him finding out about it. But I've only been doing it so that we could save more money."
She produced a building society paying in book.
"Look, I've put every penny into our joint savings account for our flat. So this 100 I put in every week just for a couple of hours on Friday afternoons. It's really nice. Look how it's mounted up, almost £1,000 already."
Sure enough, there were the credits. Every Monday morning she'd paid in the 100.
But it was the 2 hours every Friday afternoon that really got me guessing.
I asked her point-blank what the 2 hours involved.
"I go over to Park Lane and visit Mr. Farrington, Mr. Lucan Farrington."
"That name rings a bell. Isn't he the financier who has reputedly never made a mistake?"
"I don't know about that, but he's very rich, apparently.
Very, very rich, yes. And very, very old, yes. And he gives you £100 to visit him every Friday afternoon."
She started to cry again.
"It's not like you think."
"It isn't?"
"No. But Richard will just believe the worst if he ever finds out, and we shall be finished. Would you do me a big favour, John, and see if he's still waiting outside?"
"Well," I hesitated. I have a very British reluctance to get involved in emotional issues.
"If he's gone, I can get a taxi and still get to Mr. Farrington's in plenty of time."
I gave in. In spite of painful lessons over the years, I am still a pushover for a woman's tears. So I hurried to the club entrance and sauntered out under the awning. Then I looked up at the sky to convey the impression that I was checking the weather, and having taken in the street right and left, I sauntered back. Richard was parked about 50 yards down to the right. He was sitting on his moped with his arms folded across his chest and his lips set in a straight line. I reported this to Jennifer. She started to cry again, and I gave her a bit of advice which, I admit, has often got me into trouble when I have followed it myself. "Why not go out there and say, 'Darling, I can explain everything?'"
"He'll want to know exactly what I've been doing."
I agreed that his curiosity was likely to be aroused.
"And I can't tell him," she said. "He'd never believe it."
"Why shouldn't he believe it?"
"Because he's got such rigid ideas. He'd think that just because I go to Mr. Farrington's and make coffee and take off my clothes in his bedroom and then pull the blind down, well, Richard would flip."
"You take your clothes off?"
"Only for a minute or two, and I have my back to him, and I wear a warm dressing gown when I'm pouring the coffee."
"You pour his coffee?"
"Yes."
"What does he do with it?"
"With the coffee?"
"Yes."
"What do you mean?"
"Do you pour it over him, or what?"
"I don't understand. Mr. Farrington has it on a tray by his bed."
Then what happens?"
"Mr. Farrington lights a cigarette. It has to be a Gauloise, apparently. One week he'd forgotten to get any, so he cancelled everything and paid me off."
"Right. So he's smoking?"
"Yes, and there's the smell of the special coffee in the room. That's very important. And I go back behind the screen and take off the dressing gown. Now we're getting close to the moment he's waiting for. I go to the window with my back to him, and I reach up to pull down the blind. The cord's a few inches out of reach. I stand on tiptoe and still can't reach it."
"What's Mr. Farrington doing?"
"Watching, I suppose. So I put one knee on the dressing table and stretch up to get hold of the cord."
"Then what happens?"
"Nothing. We've never got it exactly right up to now. Either the cord's been too high for me to reach, or I haven't knelt properly. I'm only supposed to put one knee on the table, but he's always very nice about it. He just tells me to get dressed and go home. When I've got dressed, I call in to say goodbye, and he gives me an envelope with the money in it, and he asks after Richard and my father. He's a sweet old thing, really. I asked her if she'd really told me everything. Yes. Well, I didn't mention the chair with the cane seat. What about it? That's the chair I have to sit on behind the screen. It's a particular chair. French, I think. What's particular about it? It's the chair that Mr. Farrington tells me to sit on, otherwise it doesn't work. What doesn't work? I was frustrated by the mystery of it all. Whatever it is he's after. That's what I don't understand. Neither do I. But if that's what turns him on, well, good luck to him. Where did you meet? In the club. He came in for lunch one day and gave me a very big tip. Then he came next day and explained what he wanted. I was about to ask exactly what it was he wanted when there was the sound of a moped starting up in the street. Jennifer grabbed my arm. She thought it was Richard's. Would I look and see if he'd gone? Off I went. The street was quite clear. Richard had evidently got fed up and left. I went back. Jennifer looked at her watch. Would you do me another big favour, John? I gave a sort of non-committal, Get me a taxi to go to Curzon House Park Lane. Okay, I said. Thanks very much. I do appreciate it. I'll put my hair up and get the wig on very quickly. What wig? Didn't I tell you? It's a long blonde wig that Mr. Farrington bought for me. He likes me to have it on when I arrive, and I take the pins out behind the screen so that the hair hangs down my back when I'm reaching for the blind. I got a taxi within minutes, and in she got. As it disappeared round the corner, I stood for a moment conjecturing about the strange ritual she was going to perform at Mr. Farrington's. Suddenly I felt a hand grip my shoulder and twist me round to face Jennifer's Richard. "What's going on?" he spoke with his teeth clenched. "There's nothing going on that I know of," I replied, with what must have been a very sickly smile. "Where did Jennifer go in that taxi?" "To visit Mr. Farrington." "Who's Mr. Farrington?" "Rich financier." "What's his address?" "I don't know." "Yes, you do." "No, I don't." "Yes, you do." "No, I don't." "You gave it to the taxi driver. I saw you." "Curzon House Park Lane." "Right. Come with me." Richard grasped my forearm and propelled me round the corner where his moped was propped up by the curb. "Get on," he said. "What?" I said, playing for time. "You heard. Get on the back. We're going to Park Lane." I'd never been on a moped before, and the shock of zooming off at speed took my breath away. By the time we got to the prestigious Curzon House and Richard was trying to get the porter to admit us, I was too weak at the knees to make a run for it, even if I'd wanted to. The fact is, I was intrigued by the situation, and since I was an innocent party, I thought I'd hang on and possibly meet this Mr. Farrington. I had in mind possible finance for my production of Harriet's Diary, but the porter was obviously not impressed by Richard's moped and wouldn't let us pass the desk. "Mr. Farrington never sees anyone without an appointment. He doesn't like being disturbed." "Oh, bet he doesn't," said Richard. "Filthy old swine." He leaned forward. "Were you here when my fiancée arrived?" "Your fiancée?" "A few minutes ago in a taxi." "We have people coming and going all day. Many of them are women. How can I be expected?" At this point, he was interrupted by a youthful policeman. "Is that your moped outside, sir?" "Yes." "Do you realise it's parked in a prohibited area? May I see your driving licence, tax certificate?" "No, I've got to see this Mr. Farrington." "It's a non-parking area. The sign is quite clear." Richard started to shout. So did the constable. Just as they seemed likely to become physical, I spoke quietly to the porter. "Would it be possible for you to phone Mr. Farrington's flat and tell Miss Norton that her fiancé is here?" This had a magical effect. "Miss Norton? Miss Jennifer Norton?" "Yes." "Are you friends of hers?" "Certainly we are. This gentleman is actually her husband-to-be." "Why didn't you say so? It's all right, officer. I'll put the moped into the residence car park," he turned to us. "Please go up to number 98. It's on the 9th floor. The lift is over there." On the way to the 9th floor, I indulged in a brief fantasy in which I fought off an attack on the millionaire by a jealous fiancée. The grateful old man financed Harriet's diary, and it cleaned up in 50 countries. I was working on my acceptance speech for the Oscar ceremony just as we got to the door of number 98. Richard hammered on it, and it was opened by a well-scrubbed butler in a white jacket who held on to the doorknob and left no space for anyone to push past. Richard spoke to him aggressively. "Where's my fiancée?" the butler relaxed. "Is it Mr. Richard?"
"Yes. Oh, but do come in, sir. Miss Norton will be finished in a few minutes."
He showed us into a small room off the hall. He asked us if he could get us anything. Richard was disarmed. As the butler backed out of the room, Richard stopped him.
"Wait a minute. What is going on here?"
"I beg your pardon, sir?"
"With my fiancé and Mr. Farrington."
"The usual, sir."
"So I was right, was I?" Richard flared up again. He grabbed the butler. "Where are they? Which room are they in?"
"Please let go of my lapel, sir. I abhor violence in any form, but if I am provoked, I shall not hesitate to make use of the Japanese martial art of which I have made a lifetime study."
Richard let go.
"Has Miss Norton never told you about her role here, Mr. Richard? About the French room and the cane chair and the coffee with chicory?"
The chicory was news to me, but I made no comment. Richard looked incredulous.
"It's Mr. Farrington's little hobby. It requires the cooperation of Miss Norton. He's tried other young ladies, but physically Miss Norton has come closest. Mr. Farrington is always most appreciative. Afterwards he always inquires about you and how you're both getting on with your savings.
I don't want his patronage. I want my fiancée."
The butler looked at his watch. "Wait a few minutes and they'll be out."
"Out of where?"
"The French room."
"What exactly is the French room?"
"It's actually one of the spare bedrooms. Mr. Farrington went to great expense to have it remodeled. He employed a designer to go over to Nice, the Hotel Mirabel. He created an exact replica."
"Replica?" "Down to the last detail. Brass bedstead, screen, cane chair, the lot. He even had a theatrical lighting expert come and create the effect of sunlight coming in through the shutters. It's an incredible effect."
"And where does my fiancée come in?"
"I'm not sure of the details of the ritual. That is a matter between Miss Norton and my employer."
"Well, now there's another person involved. Where is the French room?"
"Mr. Farrington doesn't permit anyone to go near until Miss Norton leaves."
"Too bad. He's in for a surprise."
With that, Richard strode out of the room and along the hall. The butler made no move to stop him. He turned to me.
"He won't be able to get in. Mr. Farrington always locks the door."
"Hardly surprising," I thought. The butler and I went out into the corridor. Richard had found Jennifer's raincoat just outside a door, unlike the other doors in the flat. It was oak and had a brass handle. It was French. Richard beckoned me to join him.
"Listen," he said. "I want another witness."
I put my ear to the door and heard an old man's voice, rather quavery. He was giving someone, presumably Jennifer, precise instructions.
"That's it. Now reach up. One knee on the table. You still can't quite reach it. Stretch. That's it. Now catch the cord in your hand. Perfect. Marvellous. Bravo, Chantal. At last." There was a pause, and then a chuckle, followed by a sigh of satisfaction. This was drowned immediately by Richard thumping the door with his fists. I heard a stifled scream from Jennifer and a moan from Mr. Farrington. There was another pause, and then Jennifer opened the door. She was pulling on her dressing gown.
"Richard, darling, I can explain everything."
But Richard had already pushed past her and gone to the bedside.
Mr. Farrington was lying there, very white and not moving.
"You dirty old—" Richard raised his arm to strike, but stopped it in mid-air. Then he bent down and looked closely.
The butler arrived and hurried across to the bed. He put his ear to Mr. Farrington's chest.
"I think he's gone."
Jennifer clutched at Richard. The butler stood up. His bottom lip quivered.
"He's gone all right. The banging on the door is what did it. Why did you have to do that?"
Richard just bowed his head and didn't speak. The butler pulled the sheet up over Mr. Farrington. It had all happened in seconds. Richard listening, the voice saying, "Bravo, Chantal," and then the knock, the door opening, and the butler telling us Mr. Farrington was no more. A doctor was sent for. I can't remember what anyone said. Not much, that's for sure. But when we were all in the kitchen where the butler had made tea, Jennifer tried to explain everything to Richard. She repeated pretty well what she'd told me, and then she went on.
"The interesting thing is that we never managed to get it quite right until today.
and this was the first time he ever told me exactly what it was he was trying to do. I think perhaps that helped me. I'm so pleased we made it.
What do you mean?
What was he trying to do?
He was trying to recapture the happiest moment of his life.
She took a sip of tea, and we all waited for her to go on.
50 or more years ago, he was sent to Paris by his father to learn the language so he could take over the family business. He was completely under his father's thumb, apparently, and his mother's. Never had a girlfriend, until he was in Paris and fell for this chorus girl. But his parents got to hear about it and went over to stop it. But Mr. Farrington and the girl gave them the slip and ran away to Nice. On a train, a blue one, apparently, and they went to this hotel, the Mirabelle. He'd never slept with a girl before. Next morning they had coffee sent up. It's taken him weeks to get the right blend. And then the girl, Chantal her name was, slipped her dressing gown off and sat down to comb her hair, sat on the chair with the cane seat. Well, she was just going to get back into bed when Mr. Farrington said she'd better pull down the blinds. The sun was shining, and she reached up. The chair had left some marks on her bottom, and he made some joke. And then she stretched up to pull down the blind. But she wasn't quite tall enough, so she put one knee on the table and just managed to catch hold of it.
"What was he doing all this time?" Richard asked.
"Well, that moment, apparently, that was the moment that was the happiest of his life. He'd held this girl in his arms all night, and he knew that in a moment she was going to get into bed again. They laughed about the cane pattern on her bottom. There was this smell of coffee and the Gauloises. Well, it was just a perfect moment. And this afternoon was the first time we've ever managed to get everything right. I know we did, because he told me he wouldn't say Bravo, Chantal, until we did. That's what he said originally, apparently."
Jennifer blew her nose.
"Well, then came the knock at the door. That's what happened originally, too. It was his parents. They hammered on the door, just like you did. That's what must have killed him, because just after he'd said Bravo, Chantal, he let them in, and everything was finished. They threatened the police, and she ran away. He was taken back to England and made to feel he'd broken his parents' hearts. So he just did what they wanted and made money, and he was extremely successful, apparently."
"Multi-millionaire," I said.
Richard was looking at Jennifer. "And is that really all you had to do?" "Yes, I'm so happy we made it in the end. He must have died happy." The butler stood up.
"I'm sure he did. And, miss, he was sure you would manage it all right in the end, but just in case you never did, or he sort of popped off between Fridays, he put this envelope aside for me to give you."
He took a large manila envelope out of his pocket and handed it to Jennifer.
"It's £50,000 for the flat you planned to share with Mr. Richard."
Jennifer started crying again. Richard put his arm around her. She looked up.
"That was nice of him, wasn't it, Richard? Of course, he didn't know you were going to kill him."
I liked her saying that. It sort of put Richard in his place.
"And so far as I know, they both lived happily ever after. I went back to my flat, ruminating on the irony of finally meeting a really well-heeled potential backer for my film of Harriet's Diary, and the fact that I didn't actually get to see him until he was no longer alive. I gave up my Soho office when Manoli increased the rent. He put a glass door on it and mirrors on the other three sides, and there's a go-go dancer there now.